So this talk was originally supposed to be given by this guy. I'm trying to impersonate him, but probably badly. So I'm not quite sure exactly what he would say, so I've guessed and added a few things that I wanted to say at the end. So I'll first give a very quick statement of the context, which we've just heard about. Then I'll talk about stability criteria in general and the sort of traditional story that you all learned in the first year in graduate school or somewhere. And then I'll talk about direct impact accretion, when it occurs and what happens to the angular momentum that is given to a star in direct impact. And I'll discuss some possibilities. And then at the end I have something which is completely unrelated to all of this, but maybe you'll find interesting. Okay, so the evolutionary context, we've just heard the story of starting off with a pair of main sequence stars. One of them becomes a giant, becomes a white dwarf. Then the next one, which perhaps is increased in mass, has unstable transfer. And perhaps we end up with a double degenerate, and that's the beginning of this story of direct impact and double degenerate. So the one possibility is that the white dwarfs are quite massive and can have either stable or other unstable transfer. The particular case that's sort of interest here is when the mass ratio is fairly extreme, maybe like 2 to 1 or something like that. So that when, as for example, gravitational radiation brings one of the degenerates, brings the two degenerates together, the lighter one, which is the larger one, begins stable transfer onto the other system. And that produces AMCVNs and LISA sources and other things that the current and previous speaker know and love. And so we would like to make many of these, but one of the questions is that most of these systems don't come in with extreme mass ratios, but as you just saw, they probably come in with mass ratios of order 1. And when the mass ratio is of order 1, the stability of transfer depends not obvious, and it depends on subtle things like direct impacts and tidal couplings. So that's the context in which if the mass ratio of the donor, if the donor is much less massive than, except for circumbinary rings and things, it's always stable. If the accretor is much heavier than the donor, it's always unstable, except if it's very radiative and things. And if it's comparable, then we get in complicated physics. I'm sorry? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, maybe I had it back. Okay. So the standard picture is for the stable transfer is that we have a donor which is less massive than the accretor. I think I got it right this time. And for example, if the donor is a low mass degenerate star, then as it loses mass, it will expand. The Roche lobe basically goes as the cube root of the mass times the separation of the two stars. So if we want to keep this star in contact with its Roche lobe, the semi-major axis goes like its mass to the minus 2/3, and therefore its mass goes as the separation to the minus 3/2. So the total orbital angular momentum goes like 1 over the separation. So if I lose through gravitational radiation, I lose angular momentum, then the orbit expands. And that's the traditional story, that if I have transfer driven by gravitational radiation, which would like to, if they were point masses, would be bringing the two stars together. In fact, under transfer, it causes orbit expansion. So the sine of the period derivative is opposite to what it would be for point masses. And this will come back later when we see the observations of some of these sources, which do not accord with theory. So the unstable transfer is the other way around. So now the donor M2 is more massive. And you can see that the problem arises then because now most of the angular momentum is in the lighter star, which is the one that's receiving it, now receiving the mass. And so if this is the lighter star, I don't have to lose very much mass from this one in order to significantly increase the mass of the acceptor. And if the angular momentum is conserved, that means that the orbit is now shrinking dramatically as the recipient collects its mass. The Roche lobe, on the other hand, because this is the most massive star, the Roche size of the Roche lobe is basically the orbit separation, and the orbit separation is shrinking, and so the Roche lobe is disappearing inside M2. And for most stars, that means that it's dynamically unstable. So we've done the two extreme limits, and it's not very hard, but I didn't write down the equations for what happens when the two are comparable, and that's basically the dividing line between stable and unstable transfer. And I'll just point out that the crucial thing that causes the instability is this fact that the semi-major axis is trying to shrink. So if I take angular momentum, orbital angular momentum, and turn it into spin, for example, of this central star, of the accreting star, that's going to make the problem even worse because I've removed orbital angular momentum and put it into spin, so that's a destabilizing tendency. On the other hand, if I have some tidal coupling, for example, that puts the angular momentum and the spin back into the orbit, that helps expand the orbit and that helps stabilize. So the question of what happens to the angular momentum that comes from the Lagrange point and gets accreted onto this star or its accretion disk matters a lot in this deciding exactly where the boundary of stability is. So if I put lots of angular momentum into spin, I make my tend to make it unstable, and if I put it back, I help stabilize it. So here's from Flannery 1975, the picture of what happens if you let material come from the L1 point. With some thermal velocities, it forms a stream which goes around the accretor, almost touches the Roche lobe, and then self-intersects here. And there are two interesting things to calculate. One is you can calculate in the frame of this star what the specific angular momentum of this stream is. You can see it's non-zero. It didn't go radially in. And you find that it tends, if you just imagine taking that material and turning it into a disk with its specific angular momentum about this star, it tends to make a disk with a size which is about 0.2 of the Roche lobe size. Depends a little bit on mass ratio, 0.2 to 0.3. Now, if the companion is very small, what generally happens is, as it has here, the stream self-intersects, there's a shock, you start to build up a disk, and then if the disk is viscous, the viscosity causes the mass to go in and the angular momentum to go out and a little bit of extra material. And so the disk gradually spreads with the angular momentum being carried out in order to enable the accretion. So material marches out, conserving angular momentum, until it gets close enough to this other star that there's some tidal coupling between the outer edge of the disk and the star, and the angular momentum, which was accreted, now gets put back into the orbit. So the standard textbook story is that due to this tidal coupling between the outer edge of the expanding accretion disk, it will always expand eventually close enough to the donor, that the angular momentum that is lost gets back into the orbit. So that's a stabilizing influence, and that's important for understanding the stability of transfer. And typically, the disk expands to something like 0.8 or 0.9 of the Roche lobe radius, again, depending on the mass ratio before the tidal coupling becomes important. So what happens in direct impact? Well, for very short period systems, this picture of white dwarfs as being small is only a relative statement. If I make the orbit small enough, then the white dwarfs are relatively big. There is a big white dwarf. And you notice that now the white dwarf is so big that it's larger than the radius of this, that the disk would initially form at, and it's larger than the radius where the two streams intersect. So a disk never forms. The material just comes off this stream and hits the white dwarf and makes a boundary layer and tries to spin up the white dwarf, and there's no accretion disk. So you might naively suppose that all that would happen is that all the angular momentum that is being lost through the L1 point is just being added to the white dwarf, and the white dwarf spins faster and faster and faster as it accretes. So some observational consequences. There's no disk. The stream is very thin and therefore optically thick, and so it doesn't produce emission lines, doesn't produce much emission. When it hits the star, you expect to have a very hot point there, an X-ray. So you might expect to get X-rays in near UV. And the two shortest period systems, indeed, were discovered by X-ray observations. modulated by something that looks like a hotspot, and there aren't emission lines from a disk, and so it's been proposed that these are examples of that. So I told you about the stability transfer. So what are the consequences of this direct impact for stability? Well, this lower line is the sort of extreme case of the limit that the mass ratio, this is M1 and M2, so this is the system which is losing mass. Below this solid curve, the mass transfer is always stable. It basically doesn't matter what happens to the angular momentum. The mass ratio is so extreme that you're always stable. Up here, you can't even be saved even if you have tidal coupling, which puts the angular momentum back into the orbit. You're always unstable up here. And it's this region in between, which is sort of mass ratios of order 2 to 1, where it actually matters whether or not you have this tidal coupling transferring angular momentum back to the orbit. Picture, which is from, I guess this is Marsh, Neelemans, and Stieg's reference here, they've parameterized things in terms of a time scale in years, 0.1, 10, and 1,000 years for tidal coupling to transfer angular momentum back from the accreting star to the orbit. And you notice that if the time scale is very short, you basically recover the standard tidally locked limit. If the time scale is very long, you're basically in the limit where it's essentially irrelevant that the coupling is happening. It's happening too slowly compared to the orbit evolution time. This is the way that they parameterized it, and it matters for a number of reasons. One is if you are interested in an observation of a particular source, this would be a constraint on the mass ratio, and unfortunately, we don't actually reliably know the mass ratios of those two systems. We don't even know that they're actually orbital periods. But if we knew the mass ratios, then we could test this theory, for example, and find out if it was clearly stable for 10 years, but it was guaranteed, this theory said it was unstable, then there would be a crisis. Or if it agreed, we would all relax. But we can't do that yet. It also matters for the population synthesis because, as I mentioned, most of the systems that are coming into contact are probably in this region. And so if we used to think that they were stable, but now they're unstable, then we're making many fewer of them. So it matters for the population synthesis. There are also scenarios, I should mention, where these systems are made with semi-degenerate or even non-degenerate stars. And there, because they're radiative, it matters. This issue matters less than for double degenerate. Okay, so here are some equations. So this is the equation for the evolution of the orbital angular momentum. And there is a loss due to gravitational radiation, familiar term. There's a loss due to the accretion. So this is the angular momentum which is being lost through the L1 point and initially going into spin. So this is the radius of that initial little small disk, the specific angular momentum of the disk, M2 dot. Then there's a term which we can think of as tidal dissipation that as I accrete material and spin up this star, the capital omega is the angular moment, is the angular velocity of the accreting white dwarf. And as it starts to spin faster than the orbit, there's a tidal coupling which tends to transfer angular momentum back into the orbit on a time scale tau s. And the third term, which has only recently been put in, is the possibility that in addition to the sort of standard tidal coupling, there's also the possibility that as the orbit shrinks due to gravitational radiation or expands due to accretion in gravitational radiation, you can sweep through resonances with modes of the star, which could be G modes, F modes, R modes, and inertial modes, particularly R and inertial modes. Quite important. And those modes can build up, in principle, if they had little damping, they could build up to very large amplitudes, storing, because these are close binaries, they can store amounts of energy that could, in principle, for a mode with an amplitude of order 1, be of order a significant fraction of the orbital angular momentum. You might not believe that they would build up to that amplitude, but they might. And those growing modes could do two things. One is they could lock the spin of the star, and they could also lock the orbital period, depending on whether how efficient the coupling back to the orbit was. So there have been two papers looking at different aspects of this mode. One by Rathore, Blanford, and Broderick, who considered a non-rotating star, which is somewhat curious in this context, but anyway, they considered a non-rotating star, and they found that F and G modes might conceivably lock the orbit, so basically as the star was in-spiraling through gravitational radiation, it would come to a point where the orbital frequency exactly matched the frequency of an F mode, and then all the orbital energy would be going into growing this mode, and the orbit would stay essentially locked. Etienne Racine, Phil Aras, and I have a paper which you can look at where we considered R modes, and R modes are particularly interesting because they are guaranteed to have frequencies which are of order the rotation frequency of the star. And we found that at least for brief periods, those can actually lock the spin of the accreting star and keep the spin frequency locked through the transfer. Okay. So this is just an example in this case of the R mode, that the growth of the R mode by locking the spin actually changes. This is the always stable and always unstable lines. And you can see that the R modes basically act as a stabilizing influence in this case for a relatively brief time. Now, the question of how much those matter, I think, is a little bit unclear. Personally, my suspicion is that all of this really doesn't matter, that it's very easy to keep these things tidally locked all of the time, and that a small amount of wave-wave coupling will guarantee that any modes you excite will dissipate, and that the tidal coupling will, in fact, occur on a fairly short time scale and keep the white dwarfs tidally locked. So my guess is that this direct impact accretion is not that different than the standard textbook case, except that it's tides in the white dwarf which are carrying the angular momentum back to the orbit rather than tides in the disk. But that has not been proven rigorously, is my personal opinion. Okay, status of the candidates. So these two systems, as I mentioned, the standard theory says that the orbital period shall be increasing. Both of them have orbital periods which are decreasing at just about the rates you'd expect for point masses. So the two, one obvious possibility, which has been worked out because it's the obvious one, is that they're just making the transition from being point masses to systems which are undergoing the equilibrium mass transfer rate, so they're in early stages. And there have been two calculations, one of which is to imagine that this atmosphere of the star is just starting to touch the Roche lobe, and white dwarfs have very thin atmospheres, so it doesn't take very long for the accretion rate to exponentiate. And so that one, I think, is not very plausible because the accretion rate would have been exponentially increasing on a timescale less than the observation time. Another possibility looked at by Deloy and Tom, which I think is more promising, is that actually the photosphere has gotten past that stage and is now outside the Roche lobe and in the radiative layer of the white dwarf, so that now it's actually, as mass loss occurs, because it's radiative, the envelope is tending to shrink as the mass loss happens. And so this phase can take maybe a few thousand years or even 10 to the 5 years, 10 to the 6 years to actually build up to the equilibrium accretion rate. So we're still kind of lucky to have caught one of these systems in that stage, but it's at least not so implausible as the first case. And so far as I know, again, there's still no definite confirmation that these X-ray periods, which are a hot spot on the white dwarf, are actually the orbital frequency. And in this R mode locking, for example, they could be different than the orbital frequency. Okay. So I will maybe in my 1 minute left advertise something on a completely different topic. So this is some work that I did with my graduate student, Chris Wegg. So we got interested in the question of, we read this paper which said that magnetic white dwarfs must be massive because they have lower velocity dispersions than ordinary white dwarfs. So we thought, we'll just look up what the velocity dispersion as a function of mass is and we can figure out the masses. But then we couldn't find anywhere that had actually written down the velocity dispersion as a function of white dwarf mass. So then we decided to find out what it was. So this is a sample from Palomar Green and SDSS data. White dwarfs hotter than 12,000 degrees, cooling ages 300 megayears, good signal-to-noise spectra so that one can get G, T in a photometric distance. and the result was a sample of a little bit less than 2,000 white dwarfs. And where proper motions weren't available, Chris heroically went back and measured them. So the velocity ellipsoids, given the photometric distances and the proper motions, you have the transverse velocities, but not the radial. So we computed the ellipsoids using the method of Dana and Binney, which basically allows you to infer the velocity ellipsoid statistically. And the only assumption is that the distribution is position independent. And since most of these white dwarfs are within a couple hundred parsecs, that's probably not too bad. So here's the result. Velocity dispersion is a function of white dwarf mass from 0.5, 1, 1.1 solar masses. Here's dispersion of 50 kilometers a second going down to about 20. And what you would expect is these red dots are the velocity dispersion from the Hipparchus catalog of main sequence stars, which with Ferrario's initial mass, final mass relation should have been the initial velocity dispersion of the white dwarfs. And then, of course, they have a cooling age added on top of that. And we all know that stars, as they get older, have their velocity dispersion increased by encounters with density waves and molecular clouds. So this green curve is that traditional fit. And you can see that maybe the white dwarfs are a little high, but it's not too bad, except you might get a little suspicious about this last point. So I'll end by zooming into that last point. So the last point is the white dwarfs more than 0.95 solar masses. And this is the distribution of 0.75 to 0.95. And this is bigger than 0.95. And the distributions are very different. And in particular, two of the 17 high-mass white dwarfs have velocity, transverse velocities bigger than 50 kilometers a second. And the error bars from the distances and proper motions are such that it's very hard to imagine any way you could get those stars into the group of the rest of them. So we thought, well, maybe they're runaway B stars, early B stars. Late B stars for these. And the statistics of that is that it's completely implausible that this many of them would be high-velocity stars. And if you imagine that some of these could be mergers, 0.1 solar mass white dwarfs could be the result of merging old 0.5 solar mass white dwarf pairs, which have the velocity dispersion, which is high because they're much older. That also is about a factor of 10 too low to explain these numbers, but it's only 2 out of 17, so we'll have to see.
We use SPI to do velocity, kinematics of white dwarfs as well, and I think our high-mass white dwarfs all obeyed the youngest.
Yeah, we looked at the SPI sample. It was smaller statistics, though. I think you had fewer in that.
Yeah, sure. I think we have about 12 or so, whatever. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, so again, it's 2 out
two
of 17.
Two is rare. Yeah.
So we were really looking for whether there was a merger population.
Some of the longer period AMCVNs, there's some evidence that the white dwarfs are rotating very slowly. So something like GPCOM, which is a 46-minute period, looks as though the white dwarf is no more than 50 kilometers per second equatorial velocity, which is very much slower than you might expect if it's just been accreting lots of material. Can your locking mechanism still lock at that sort of period, do you think, or any idea?
It depends on the mode. So the other subtlety is that if it's mode locking, the white dwarf tends to get locked to a spin period, which is some non-integer number fraction of the rotation period. And so depending on what you think is actually happening in producing the hot spot, you could actually have a synodic period rather than the orbital period coming out, a sort of difference period coming out. And so the interpretation could be complicated. For the particular case of R modes, I think it could do it, but it doesn't explain the business about the orbital period derivative. So I think that model is clearly not relevant for GPCOM in particular. But some of the other locking, so generically, I think it's quite hard to understand, I would say, without one of these resonant modes, I think it's quite hard to understand how you would avoid tidal synchronization, in my view. It's really clearly suborbital. I think that would probably be a good indication that there's some kind of mode coupling. But which one it is, I think there are many possibilities.
Your velocity ellipsoid, you didn't go down to low masses there. Are there no low mass ones below 0.5?
Well, I guess the way we constructed the sample, we did not include the ones with the very low G systems.
Just after Philip's comment, I just wonder whether there would be some.
Yeah, it would be interesting to look at those, but we didn't put them in this sample because we wanted to get good photometric distances, and we weren't confident in the atmospheric models for distances for those.
Could you go back several slides to that stable unstable where you have the mass ratio? Wait a minute. No, keep going. There, that one. Now the AM Canvans live on the lower right, and they have extreme mass. M2 is extremely small. M1, I don't know what M1 is, but you're down there. But can you start in the upper left and not have a complete disruption of the secondary, have an unstable period of mass transfer, but not completely disrupting the secondary so that it moves eventually to the lower right and becomes an AM Canvan?
So I think, let's see, where's Philip? Philip has a model which I believe does that. I mean, the simple-minded double degenerate is that you start here in a region which is stable and you stay stable the whole time.
Yeah.
Right, that's the standard scenario. But you can, particularly with the only partially degenerate models, you can have a finite transfer which starts unstable but then terminates without complete disruption, and mm-hmm. then you end mm-hmm. up continuing in the stable.
Because the double degenerate progenitors of the type Ralph was talking about this morning are close to Qs of 1, or much closer than that lower right region will demand. I'm not making any statement about the region in between, but.
Right. I mean, the standard scenario, you're basically sort of starting somewhere around up here mm-hmm. and trying to get down there stably.
Mm-hmm. This question is that there's a calculation by the Louisiana State Group, Gokal et al., that came out this year that was looking at exactly that question of, can you start unstable mass transfer, basically dump enough mass onto the accretor to then evolve through the instability, so that basically you end up reversing the mass ratio and evolve into a stable regime. Their answer was yes, but you know, they use just simple polytropic models, et cetera, so you know, whether or not there's something else that can come into play as you're evolving to mass transfer rates of 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 3 per year. Yeah, open question.
Yeah, this is actually a comment again. I do have to warn people to, you have to be extremely careful in using observational samples, because again, the number of AMCVN stars as basically in a volume around the sun is so incredibly much lower than the number of double white dwarfs. They're just much easier to observe. You can see them much further away. So you have to be, I mean, I don't think that the fact that we see out of the, 25 or so double white dwarfs, that are basically no ones that in this picture would be stable, that you can use that to infer anything about the AMCVN population, because simply the numbers are so wildly different. But it comes basically back to the same thing that Ralph said about the type 1A progenitors, right? I mean, if you compare double white dwarfs with super soft sources, you're looking at wildly different volumes.
Okay, well, let's thank Sterling.